Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Ohio has a rich history with many stories, from the Underground Railroad to coal mining to jazz. A father-daughter duo has been recording and writing all about Ohio's history. Joining us is David Myers and Elise Myers Walker, authors of numerous books on Ohio, including its newest edition, Tales of Ohio's Underground Railroad. David, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Amy.
And Elise, welcome to All Sides.
Hi.
So you two have been writing about Ohio history for a while, and you have books that span many topics. David, how did you get into this whole writing about Ohio history and writing these books?
I've always been interested in Ohio history, and way back, I met a guy named Bob Thomas, and he was a vice president of WBNS at radio and TV, and he started doing a series of books called Columbus Unforgettables. So I joined him working on those three volumes.
Okay. And then, Elise, you decided to follow in your father's footsteps, and you've been a co-author on several books. How did you join the team here?
Well, decided is an interesting choice of words. I would say pressed.
Actually, were you voluntold?
A little bit. I went to college originally to study theater. I came out with an art history degree, which is a different story entirely. But while I was there, I was part of a theater company run by an incredibly dynamic woman who had all kinds of cool ideas. And at one point, she decided to start a magazine. So since I was already on her payroll as an actor, suddenly I was also a magazine writer, doing interviews, doing reviews of things, whatever she needed me to do. I also happened to have a roommate who was the editor of the school newspaper, and they needed somebody who could write theater reviews. Well, having come from theater, I was more than comfortable with that. So after I graduated from college, my father said, "Hey, you've been writing. Would you like to continue writing? And we could write something together." And, you know, we're both lifelong Ohioans, so it just makes sense that we'd write about the place we love.
What was the first book you wrote together? What was it about?
The first book that was published that we wrote together was on Central Ohio's historic prisons. In my father's first career, he's retired 30 years from working in corrections. So that was an easy one. We actually started writing a book on little cities of black diamonds, the Hocking Hills area, before that, but it didn't get published until many years later.
Okay. So, David, how do you figure out what topics you want to write about? You've written about a wide variety of things.
Yeah. Elise and I say we write the books that we wish somebody else had written. As subjects that we run across, and there doesn't seem to be anything about it. So we figure there's a gap there for us to fill. Like the way we got into writing the current book, it started back two books ago. And for years, I've been interested in how African-Americans settled in Ohio. The former slaves, the free blacks, the fugitives. And my mother grew up near one of the settlements, which was Carthagena up in Mercer County. And she used to tell me about it when I was a kid. And so we wrote a book called Historic Black Settlements of Ohio because, again, there was a void. No one had written anything like that before, in which we talk about over 40 of these settlements, give the histories of them. And that was as far as we ever thought we'd go as far as Underground Railroad was concerned. But in writing those, we found so many stories that we hadn't read anywhere that we ended up writing another book.
What was the next one? Yeah.
The Reverse Underground Railroad in Ohio.
And what's the Reverse Underground?
The Reverse Underground Railroad, we thought, that's a catchy title.
It is. I'm intrigued.
But basically, it refers to the slave catchers who came to Ohio to capture the runaways.
Oh.
And what we wrote was a book about how the law regarding the treatment of fugitive slaves changed during the antebellum period in the South, and it affected the way people responded and how they were handled once they got into Ohio. And so this is very much driven by the law and changes in case law and things. And so it's from the standpoint of the slave catchers.
Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say the long and short of it is that white Ohioans had the option to be apathetic about slavery for a very, very long time. As the laws progressed, they were no longer allowed to be apathetic. That was suddenly against the rules. You could be ordered to help hunt down an enslaved person who had run away.
Or someone suspected of being one.
Okay. So then those two books led you to the book that was just published this month.
Yes, Tales of Ohio's Underground Railroad. And in here, each time we approach it differently. This one, each chapter starts out with a question. Because we've noticed one of the things that concerns us is people who are deliberately distorting history. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when they bring in things like, you know, the whole idea of slave quilts being used to guide people.
Is that true?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
And we've all probably heard that story.
Yeah, we show the scholarship that disputed that. And other things like you've seen those black jockey figures, you know, that
the lawn jockey.
The lawn jockey things.
Okay.
There's a whole group of people that say those were used to guide fugitive slaves.
I'm guessing you're going to tell me that's not true.
It's not true, mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we don't, what we really get annoys us is things like people who say they have a run underground railroad home, and then they promote it by having seances, and, you know, they have all these ghost stories that they want to do. And we think that's really demeaning to the memory of people who may have suffered under slavery to exploit them that way.
Yeah, at least, you know, you said that one of the goals in creating this book is you want to discourage people from telling myths. I'm sure that there's a lot of places in Ohio where they say that they have an Underground Railroad story.
Yes, and this gets tricky because the Underground Railroad was a secret network. Mm-hmm. The operators didn't necessarily know each other. You didn't know the whole route. You just knew, I get people and then I send them here.
Right. It wasn't written about on purpose.
It was kept secret on purpose.
Because you were violating the law.
Yeah.
You could be prosecuted for doing it.
There are rare instances where people, because of their prominence, usually white people, because of their prominence in the town, said, I don't care, I'm going to do this openly. But those are exceedingly rare. So what you have is a lot of people who, for touristy reasons, are going, yeah, we had an Underground Railroad house with zero proof. Mm-hmm. What they have is a coal bin or a pantry or something. They're like, oh, yeah, enslaved people could hide here. Or it's a coal bin or it's a pantry and you have no real proof. And it's one thing to say we believe this may have happened and we have these reasons why. We go through the book. Here's what an abolitionist looked like primarily. Here's what could lead you to believe someone was an abolitionist. There are places that have made up wholesale people. This enslaved person came through and this was her story. And again, that usually leads into a ghost story and then you can pay them to tour. And that's what we find. Yeah, just really disgusting. It's one thing to say we believe this, but don't have the proof behind it yet. And it's an entirely other thing to say this is absolutely true when you have nothing.
Yeah. There are some houses that weren't even built back.
Like the timeline doesn't check out.
The timeline doesn't check out. And what you run to a lot are, where they flip the history, where these people weren't abolitionists, and all once they become abolitionists secretly and are contributing to the Underground Railroad, you know, and it's
despite the fact that all of their public work was absolutely in opposition, and they were helping to pass legislation that caused trouble, and
some people, you know, believe that, you know, every old house needs a good story.
Right.
And Underground Railroad stories are really good stories if you're trying to sell an old house.
This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from all sides that introduces you to interesting people from the Buckeye State with a story to tell. Today, we're talking with David Myers and Elise Myers Walker, authors of numerous books on Ohio history, including the newest edition, Tales of Ohio's Underground Railroad. Now, when you're researching your books, whether it be this one or any of them, do you do a lot of library time or do you go to places?
Both.
Okay. So, David, tell me about, you know, visiting a location.
Well, I went to Spring Hill, which is in Massillon, Ohio, just outside in an area that was called Kendall. And it's a very neat old house. Dates back to about 1820. And the family that settled there they were very wealthy. They were Quakers. They did a lot of development in that area. And it was always, there were abolitionists, that was known. There were stories about things they had done, but they are kind of secondhand. But the interesting thing is, many years later, fortunately, people lived in that house that realizes how historical it was, and they've pretty much preserved it. And it's been passed on several generations, but it still looks great. many years later, you know, if we're talking about into the, you know, 20th century, they found this pickle barrel in one of the outbuildings. And nobody had ever opened it before. It was stuffed with paperwork.
Really?
And there they found letters from a fugitive slave who stayed there. And he was writing and thanking them for harboring him and also asking that they do the same for his wife, who would also be coming along. And he even indicated which person they should avoid because the person, you know, was duplicitous and would turn her in if they encountered him and if she came through her, him. Yeah.
Elise, do you have a favorite place that you visited in researching a book?
Oh, that's tough because, one, we are always researching. We're never not researching. And so we are always visiting places. It's difficult because the... You know, you were talking about the lack of housing on your last hour, which is a really important issue. There's a lack of preservation of historic houses as well, particularly those that are confirmed related to the Underground Railroad. It's expensive to keep up something like that. It's difficult to turn it into a museum, make it a place that people want to visit. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the times when we go to look at something, it is just a foundation or it's just... Churches usually stick around a little bit longer than anything else, but they still might be in incredible disrepair. In fact, we also find that the people in the areas might have no idea what the history is. My father had a discussion with a police officer, actually, on one of the trips about that.
Do you want to tell about that?
Well, that was when that was in the Historic Black Settlements book. But yeah, I was in Rumbly, Ohio, which there isn't much left there. But I'm trying to get a photograph of a school building, an old school building. And the police officer was parked in front of it. And he said, I bet you'd like me to move my car, wouldn't you? I said, yeah, I'm trying to get a picture of this building because it was a remnant of Rumley, which was a historic black settlement. And he said, what are you talking about? And so I went through the story with him. He said, I've lived here my whole life. I've never heard that.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was living, well, he was living, he was parked.
Yeah.
About a half a mile away from the historic marker at a church.
That said everything.
Told,
and he just never read the historic marker.
He just never read it. And there's also a cemetery there. Mm-hmm. And there's a house that across from the church that looks suspiciously like the architecture that was prevalent in those communities.
Do you have, I don't know if you have like a favorite librarian. Do you have people who help you with the research? Or are you your own favorite?
No, we, whatever we, we love the Columbus Public Library. Yeah. You're correct. A lot of research is done there. Whenever we have someone who helped us or went to extraordinary lengths for us, we always do the acknowledgments at the beginning of the book. So we've had, over the years, over more than a dozen books together, we've had many, many wonderful librarians.
Yeah. I mean, the Columbus Public Library is great. Grandview Library is great. You know, we use those a lot because we're here. But when we're going out into other areas of Ohio, I always find... If you find these real small town libraries, they throw everything open to you because they're not used to anybody asking questions. And we were just in, I forget what the name of the town was, but it's for the next book that's coming up. And the things we wanted to see, they were just laid out on a counter in this one room. They just directed us into them so we could handle them and take photographs of them and... They weren't behind glass or in a separate room or anything.
Yeah, just a small town on the Ohio River. And
when
we didn't call ahead or anything either, we walked in and said, hey, do you have this? And they let us
treat it. So libraries are great. I mean, we're always very supportive of libraries.
So your book that's out, right, that just came out is Tales of Ohio's Underground Railroad. What book is next? What are you researching now?
It's either going to be called Eccentric Ohioans or Ohio Eccentrics. I don't know which.
I've been referring to it as the weirdo book when I talk about it, but it'll have a cleaner title than that.
Yeah.
So you're talking, so basically it's going to be a book about interesting people.
It's going to be short. You know,
don't steal Fascinating Ohio.
Each chapter will be a biography of someone that was eccentric for some reason, but somebody that should be remembered.
Okay, so someone from the past who you've discovered
who
needs their story told.
Someone obvious like, you know, Annie Oakley. You know, but even some that aren't as obvious, but we tried to include, you know, We've got Native Americans, we've got women, we've got African Americans.
That's part of all of our writing, is we really try to tell the stories of the historically marginalized communities, whether they are people of color or women, or who is not normally included when the history of this era time is discussed. And that is something that we actively work on in all of our books.
Yeah. And you have written more than a dozen with your dad. Do you have a favorite?
I'm a true crime girly. So we have written a couple of true crime books, but my favorite by far is Columbus Historic Crimes book.
Okay.
Yeah.
And David, just as a final question, do you have a favorite? You've written more than a dozen. You've written before your daughter joined you, so.
Yeah, my favorite's always the one that I'm working on.
Okay, so this eccentric Ohioan's book is your favorite right now?
Actually, I look beyond that because we're working on the one for the year following that and the one for the year following that.
Oh.
Plus four or five others that may come out during that period, too.
Well, never a dull moment in the book industry with you. Yes.
No.
All right. Well, thank you to David Myers and Elise Myers Walker, authors of numerous books about Ohio history, including more to come. Their latest edition is Tales of Ohio's Underground Railroad. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides, and I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk to Ohioans with an interesting story to tell. Joining us now is Columbus native Christopher Tsunami, who is an all-around creative, writer, philosopher, musician. He also has a day job as a computer software developer. He recently wrote a book, The Partially Examined Life, written together with members of a popular philosophy podcast of the same name. Welcome to Fascinating Ohio, Christopher.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure for me to be here.
So you wrote this book, The Partially Examined Life, written together with members of this podcast that I mentioned. Can you tell me what made you decide to do this book?
Sure. So I should mention I edited the book. Mm. So I do have some pieces I wrote in it, but most of it is from this podcast. And the podcast was in around about 15 years. And it was really a great opportunity, I think, to connect philosophy with the general public, because that's something that this podcast is really good at. A lot of times when we think of philosophy, we think of it as something in the ivory tower. It's something very removed from ordinary people. And their strength on their podcast is making it accessible. And they've been on for 15 years, so I had a real opportunity to kind of go through their whole archive and pick out the pieces that I thought were the most interesting and the ones that were the most important.
I mean, as someone who works in radio and podcasts by extension, having a podcast around for 15 years is kind of a rarity. I mean, it must be a very popular one. Can you tell me about the Partially Examined Life? What are some of the things that they dig into that you featured in the book?
Sure. So they started out, actually, they were a group of philosophy students who none of them completed their philosophy program, which
there's a philosophy joke in there somewhere, yeah.
Probably. So they were all in a graduate program, and actually I could identify with that because I also was at one time in a graduate program for philosophy, which I did not complete.
Oh, that's okay.
Well, part of it is that there's a certain way the academy does philosophy, and which can be very removed and I kind of call it dead philosophy in a certain way. Mm. It's something that you study. It's a historical artifact. Whereas for this group, and I think for me, philosophy is something more alive. It's something more current. And so what I did when I was selecting the episodes was really look for those things that really speak to the current moment. So the fascinating ones that I found most interesting while I was going through them, there was one by Hannah Arendt, who was a survivor of the Holocaust. Hmm. And she had written a book about the trial of a famous Nazi, Eichmann. And her book is called The Banality of Evil. And it's just about how really bad things can happen. And we think of it as monsters creating these bad things. But actually, a lot of times it's ordinary people and how that happens. So I thought that one was a really fascinating one. One of the things I tried to do as well with the selection was that a lot of times when we think of philosophy, we think, you know, just kind of the usual suspects, Plato and Descartes, Hume. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's a real wealth of philosophy kind of outside of the Western European canon. So some of the episodes that we feature in the book have to do with Buddhist philosophers, Hindu philosophers, philosophers of the Tao, and then also figures like James Baldwin, bell hooks, and people that are not always on everybody's philosophy reading list and kind of the perspective they bring.
Now, is it kind of like a transcript of the podcast, or as the editor, did you kind of like make it more of a narrative?
Yeah, so it kind of started from a transcript, but a straight transcript would not be the most fun thing to read. So it's really heavily edited and kind of created more of like a conversation. So one thing I did as an editor was kind of insert myself into the episodes as if I was there. And I want to express that it's a very different experience from listening to the podcast. Even if you're a fan of the podcast, I think there's new things that you can find in it. But it's definitely meant to be read, and it's meant to be something that's going to speak on the printed page.
And you also are featuring some photos as well, right?
Yeah, so those are really kind of probably for the fans of the podcast. But if they want to see what these voices on the air look like, and I was able to get some photos from their early years and childhood and things like that. So
this is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and we're talking with Christopher Tsunami, who is an all-around creative, writer, philosopher, and musician, and we're talking about a book that he has edited. But now we can move on to your next project that's currently happening. You have a series of lectures running on alternating Wednesdays in the spring, and it's called Philosophy of Activism. Where did this idea come from?
So I should say it's not philosophy of activism.
I'm sorry. No, you're right. I didn't read it correctly. Philosophy as activism. I apologize.
Yeah, I really wanted to stress that because those are two really different things, I think. So philosophy of activism would be kind of studying activism. But philosophy as activism is the ways that philosophy can be active in the world. And a lot of times, again, I know I've said this several times, but we tend to think of philosophy as something just to study and something to look at. But philosophy is really, it's about what's most important. It's about what do we think the meaning of life is. And because of that, philosophy creates vision. Vision creates unity, and unity creates action. So this is a time period in the world where there's a lot of kind of crises going on. And it was important for me to think, like, what should my response be to that? And I realized that if I really have the belief that I've always preach that ideas are important and that ideas change things, then the most important thing I can do is to put ideas out there. And I do think it's really important to change the conversations that we're having right now.
Philosophy as activism, where can people learn more about these lectures? Is it something they can go to, or tell me about the events?
Yes, so they are free. They're we just had the first one last night, and then they're going to be going through the end of April. They're every 2 weeks, and they're going to be hosted at the Cooperative Chess Cultural Center, which is 80 Parsons Avenue. Mm-hmm. And if people want to find out more about them, they can go to my website, which is kitoba.com. That's K-I-T as in Tom, O-B as in boy, A.com. And the full list of topics will be there. I'm also hoping to eventually have them posted on YouTube. So mm-hmm. for people who haven't seen them. The first one that we just did was on the topic of reality and what is reality. And then we're going to continue the series with religion as technology, structure, identity, and community.
So do you have certain people coming in, or are you doing the lectures?
Yeah, no, it's I'm leading the lectures, but the conversation will also depend on who shows up. Mm-hmm. So, but there's not other guest speakers.
Okay. The website that you mentioned, say that again, because
Kitoba.com, K-I-T-O-B-A.
Yeah, what is that? What is Kitoba?
That's a good question. So it's actually just, my first name is Christopher.
Yeah.
And Kitoba is just a nickname, and it's one I got many years ago as an exchange student in Kenya. And I had a friend who just said that Christopher was not a name that sounded good in Swahili. So he said in Swahili it would sound more like Kitoba. So I've always liked that.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I just, yeah, that's it. Well, that is a fair enough reason to have that be your website. It's a beautiful name. Yeah, beautiful nickname to have. So you are also on the board at the Community Development for All People, and you run, you have a long-running Music Mondays community music outreach. Can you tell us how that started?
Sure. So Community Development for All People it's the social missions arm of the Church for All People, United Methodist Church for All People. Mm-hmm. And that's a community I've been a part of for past 20 years. And it started out as a mission project. A lot of people know it best for the United Methodist Free Store, which is a place where they take items and clothing and goods, and kind of like a thrift store concept, but everything is free. Mm-hmm. And that's been running for 20 years. And then the church actually grew out of the thrift store. It was the community, and the unique thing about it is it's a very diverse community, not just racially, but also socioeconomically, which I think is a lot more rare. So it's a place where you can find CEOs and people who slept on the street kind of sitting side by side and interacting. So that's the community that kind of all these missions grow out of. And
the music that you do. Tell me about Music Mondays.
Yeah, the music part of that. That's a program I started because I was really interested in different ways of outreach. And music is something that I'm really passionate about. It's something a lot of people are really passionate about. But there's a lot of people who feel like they need permission to do music. There's a lot of people who have been told, you know, that they don't have talent. And my kind of mission was to reach the people who had a heart for music, but maybe had never had a way to express that. And so when we started the program, I really went in with a lot of plans and vision. It was initially a youth program. It was for youth at the church. But one of the things we found was that there were people of all ages who were kind of hungry for that. And I also found that, especially with that community, it was impossible for me to plan it effectively. So as the years have gone by, really what happens is I just show up at a consistent time. It's every Monday, 6 p.m. at the community center, which is 911 Parsons Avenue. Mm-hmm. And whoever shows up that week is who's there. And whatever they're interested in is what we do. So,
what instrument do you play?
My primary instrument right now is probably guitar, but I took violin all through my childhood years. I still play that. I play piano, and I really can probably play anything that has strings on it.
Mm. Okay. Well, and your bio lists a number of accomplished ancestors. So you have quite the storied history in your family, a Revolutionary War hero, the second black landowner in Ohio, a Tuskegee Airman. When you think about all of that, what do you feel about your legacy when you have that kind of history behind you?
Well, I'm especially glad to be here in Fascinating Ohio. One of the things is when I was growing up, I'm mixed race. So my mom's family is black. My dad's family is Japanese American. And I always felt like an outsider and a foreigner. And something I didn't learn until I was an adult is that my family history actually stretches back in Ohio to prior to Ohio being created as a state. So one of my ancestors, as you said, was a mixed-race Revolutionary War hero, and he was given land in Ohio for his service. and he became the second black landowner in Ohio, and my family's been here ever since.
Oh, wow.
And my grandfather, who was the Tuskegee Airman, was actually born into a mixed-race community in Ohio that's existed there since the start of the state. And I think that's a history most people aren't aware of.
And your dad, John Tsunami, is a public artist. Your grandfather, who you just mentioned, but also he was a renowned photographer. Your wife is also an artist. So do you feel that you were, like, destined to be in the arts world?
Yeah, I was definitely born in an arts family. And I should mention, my maternal grandfather was the Tuskegee Airman.
Okay.
My paternal grandfather was the photographer.
Oh, okay. I'm getting them mixed up. I'm sorry.
But, yeah, my father and my wife are both public artists, and their work can be seen around Columbus. So my dad did the planters that are along High Street.
Oh.
So the kind of the ornamental planters.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah.
And then my wife's art can be seen various places around town. Notably, she has a mural on Cleveland Avenue just north of 670.
Wow.
And she also is in a show right now that's at the Columbus Airport.
Oh, really? Okay. And I have in here that you also, there was a major retrospective of some work in Washington, and then it came here and was featured at the Cultural Arts Center. So what was that showcasing?
Yeah, so the work was, there was a retrospective of my grandfather's work, and that's in Washington State, not Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And he was well-known during his lifetime, but it had kind of been forgotten since then. And actually, his work had been rediscovered recently, which I was really glad about because he was an amazing artist. He worked most closely with the modern dancer, Martha Graham, mm. and he was her close collaborator for many years. And we wanted to bring his work to Columbus, but we also wanted to showcase other members of the family. So it feels like just yesterday to me, but I think it's been probably about 6 or 7 years ago. But the Cultural Arts Center was our host, and they were really wonderful. And so we showcased my grandfather's work, my father's work, my wife's work, and my sister, who's also an artist, had work. And then we also had a performance of some of the music that I've written. So it was a really wonderful experience.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in today, and I want to thank you, or I want to wish you good luck on your lecture series.
Thank you so much.
Remind us, tell us the website where they can find out more about that again.
It's kitoba.com, KITOBA.com.
All right. Well, thank you to Christopher Tsunami, an all-around creative, a writer, philosopher, and musician, not to mention his day job as a computer software developer. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides that introduces you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Montaña de Luz in Spanish translates to Mountain of Light. For 25 years, the Central Ohio-based nonprofit has been a beacon of hope to those it serves in Honduras. What started initially as hurricane relief following the devastation of Hurricane Mitch in 1998 turned into a relief effort of a different kind. That's after members of the charity encountered children with HIV and AIDS and wanted to do more. Doug Haddix serves on the board of directors of Montaña de Luz and is the past president of the group. Welcome to All Sides, Doug.
Thank you very much for having me.
So earlier this year, you made your third trip to Honduras. Can you give us a sense of the work you and others are doing on these visits?
Primarily, we call these immersion trips now. Mm-hmm. So we are immersing people in the culture of Honduras, helping them learn more about HIV/AIDS, and spending time with the youth and the staff at our children's home. We typically do a work project as well. So last month, one of the things we did was we built a brick and mortar outdoor grill and cooking area that this whole staff can use.
So you have a children's home, or what does your organization have there in Honduras?
Yeah, we have a children's home where right now we have 15 young people living there, mm-hmm. ages 3 to 22. We also operate a school. Mm-hmm. We have a community outreach program called Healthy Families Honduras, mm-hmm. and we serve about 50 or 55 families in the remote eastern part of rural Honduras.
How has HIV/AIDS impacted the country, the children in particular you work with?
It's been a huge problem since the 90s when mm-hmm. HIV started spreading. Honduras has the highest rate of HIV of any country in Central America. Mm-hmm. Honduras is the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere behind Haiti. So it's a combination of lack of access to health care, access to testing, and things like that that have allowed this to continue to spread.
Of all the nonprofits in all the world, what motivated you to get involved in this one?
That's a great question. I've known about Montaña de Luz for many years through my church, Worthington Presbyterian. Our church has sent teams down for 20 years mm-hmm. or so. My wife and daughter went down in 2011 or 2012. Mm-hmm. So I started learning more about it, and then it seemed like a good thing to get involved with after I got my first experience in 2018 on a trip.
So you connected with the people, you found a passion for it?
You fall in love with the children, and mm-hmm. you fall in deep respect for the staff there that takes care of them and helps them along their way, yes.
So you arrived in Honduras at the end of January of this year, just as the Trump administration was taking a lot of swift action to cut funding and staffing for the USAID program, which is the United States Agency for International Development. So Montaña de Luz doesn't receive this federal funding directly, but has still been impacted by the cuts. Can you explain the connection to your on-the-ground efforts?
Yes, all of our HIV medications for the young people that we take care of come through USAID at mm-hmm. no cost to our nonprofit. Everything else is covered by donors, largely in the U.S., but the medicine comes directly from USAID.
So are you seeing that you're not able to access the medicine, or are you not able to pay for it? Is that what's happening right now?
Right now, there is a lot of turmoil and confusion on mm-hmm. the ground. There were about 100 USAID workers in Honduras. Mm-hmm. They are all gone, we believe. The distribution network and the coordination with the health services in Honduras is now gone. Mm-hmm. So we pick up our medications once a month for the children. We have a supply that lasts for the next 2 weeks, and then we send a team to a hospital about an hour away, and they're hopeful that they will be able to get medication at that point, but it's not guaranteed.
So someone could drive to this hospital that's hours away and it not be there?
That's our worst-case scenario,
right. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so, this has to be challenging for a nonprofit. You know, are you making plans of how to keep things going in the next few months and years?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was really kind of shocking to be there at the time that mm-hmm. this whole USAID action was taken. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw a tweet from Elon Musk that he had spent the weekend putting USAID through the wood chipper. We spent that week holding children, playing volleyball with them, doing crafts with them, doing a work project to benefit them. So it was really shocking to hear what was happening, because we were looking into the faces of the people who are directly affected by this action. So we have been working, our team in Honduras has been working to try to come under the umbrella of the Global Fund, which is a nonprofit based in Switzerland. Mm. And they are guardedly optimistic that we will be able to come under their umbrella, at least temporarily, to keep the drugs, medicines coming for the children. The one fear that we have is mm-hmm. the largest donor to the Global Fund is the U.S. government. So we're not sure how much longer that would last.
Mm. So based on an annual report, your goals for last year included to support small businesses, to help families achieve financial independence, also hosting more service trips and increasing mental health support. Were you able to achieve some of that?
Absolutely. We have had more teams going down. We have another team of Ohio State students going down in May. We have a church in North Carolina that's taking a team down in June. We have a couple more trips after that. Our small business program has been remarkable. It was conceived and led by our staff in Honduras. So we have had more than 20 families benefit from small business incubator support, and they are now off the program because they can manage a business on their own now. It might be a small tortilla business or a used clothing shop or something like that.
And also your nonprofit, it's been around for 25 years, is that
yes.
right? Yeah. So you're having a gala in April. Can you tell us about this event? Because it also is a fundraiser, right?
Yes, it's called Fiesta, and it will be April 11th at St. Charles High School. Tickets are still available on our website. We expect about 250 or 300 people. It's a very nice dinner. We have a silent auction, a live auction. We have a very special guest coming from Honduras to speak, a young woman who is now 22 years old. And she came to our children's home when she was two. Mm. Her mother died. Her father was not able to take care of her. She is a tremendous success story and is the reason we do this work. She got a scholarship and went to college in Honduras. She's now fluent in English and just graduated recently from college and is looking to start her career in Honduras.
So what would you say to someone of why they should help people or in this particular community in Honduras? I mean, as I said, there's all the nonprofits that do all the things, but why this one?
Right. That's a good question because some people think, well, I can only help people who live near me. Mm-hmm. But having been down there three times, I'm not sure what these folks and these children would do without our organization right now. Unemployment mm-hmm. is about 50% in Honduras. The economy is terrible. We've developed a program. It's the only children's home in the entire country of Honduras that specializes in HIV care. Mm-hmm. So we're filling a giant vacuum in Honduras, and our U.S. dollars can make a huge impact there. And that's why I do it, because mm-hmm. you can't do everything. So I would encourage people, find one thing that you care about, that you're passionate about, and commit to that and make a difference, whether it's in Honduras or Columbus or any place. Just be active and do something.
How do you recruit more people to go on these trips? Do you have a lot of interest? Do you have a waiting list for people who want to travel with you?
Not a waiting list. A lot of it is word of mouth. And I put together a short video from our trip last month that we can share with other people who might be interested. We work through churches, university groups. We've had people from Rotary clubs go in the past. So part of the challenge is to protect the privacy of the children. We can't show their faces publicly on our website or social media. So that makes it a little more challenging to help people connect on what it's like down there and the mm-hmm. difference they'll make by spending a week with our young people.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and we're talking with Doug Haddix, who serves on the board of directors for Montaña de Luz, a nonprofit organization that empowers children and families impacted by HIV/AIDS in Honduras. Is there anything that has stuck out the most to you in your time and working for Montaña de Luz?
When I was preparing to go down for the first time, and was telling some friends about it, they said, why would you go to such a sad place? Mm-hmm. A lot of these children have HIV. They have other developmental issues or challenges. But what I found is it is one of the most joyous places I've ever been. Mm-hmm. The staff and the other young people there have created a real family. And most of these children have no one to take care of them, no family members who are able to help them or make sure they take their medicine or eat properly or get to go to school. So it's a place of great joy and laughter and love, and it's truly an inspiration. We learn as much from them as we help them when we're there.
Did you say you have about 15 children there?
Yes,
is that
right? That's
right. Is that full? Is that your capacity?
No, it fluctuates because our goal is to get children beyond institutional care. Mm-hmm. So we have been able to transition some children and young people into foster homes, mm-hmm. sometimes with a relative, sometimes with another person who is willing to take them in. So the numbers fluctuate over time.
You also direct Conversation Partners. This is a volunteer program that is helping recent immigrants and refugees practice English here in Central Ohio. So this is not related to Honduras, but kind of like tangential, right? Tell me about Conversation Partners.
It's a program that was started by Worthington Interfaith Neighbors some years ago, and we have two components. We have monthly gatherings at, this year it's Worthington Presbyterian Church is hosting. So we meet the third Tuesday of every month at 7 o'clock, break into small groups for conversation, combination of immigrants and mentors in the U.S. who are fluent in English. We also have a one-on-one program where we'll match someone with an immigrant, and they meet once a week or once every 2 weeks at a coffee shop or the library, just to help them practice the language and to navigate living here. At our last meeting, we had about 40 people show up, and we have more than 50 people connected in partnerships right now, those one-on-ones.
I saw a flyer about it. So it doesn't say learn English. It says practice English. I think that that's an important distinction, I would say.
It is, because a lot of the folks in the program are taking an ESOL formal class. Mm-hmm. But what some of them have said is they don't really have anyone at home to practice with or at work that they can just practice what they're learning. So the other side of that is there's no training required for our volunteer mentors. So it's just
A conversation.
It's very casual. It's very fun. And you get to know people that you would otherwise never meet.
So are you helping this organization, or do you actually sit down and talk to people? You're a conversationer.
Both. I'm the director of that program right now.
Okay.
And then I have a Turkish man that I meet with, and we've developed a fast friendship. And in fact, he and his wife invited my wife and me last Friday to an iftar break the fast dinner at their home. They're in the holy season of Ramadan right now. So it was amazing. It was
wonderful. Had you ever been to one before?
I had not. Yeah. I had not. So it was really remarkable. And the spirit of community grows and friendship grows through that program.
So who comes to Conversation Partners? Like, what countries are they from?
We have people from all around. A lot of it is people who have come here on refugee status. So we have participants from Iran, Afghanistan, Turkey, and then we have people from places like Taiwan, Sierra Leone, Cape Verde, lots of Brazil. So people who find themselves in the Columbus area trying to make a new life and looking for friends, navigators, and people who can just help them practice learning the new language.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of people talking to you about any worries they're having with new immigration policies coming from the federal level? Is that instead of just talking about like what you're doing this weekend, your conversations are getting a little deeper?
That's definitely happening. There is a lot of fear in refugee and immigrant communities. Some of the temporary protected status that some of our participants are on might be shortened or eliminated. We saw with Mahmoud Khalil, a green card holder who has been detained. That spreads fear because we have people in the program who have green cards. We have other people who are on temporary protected status. And there is fear right now. Mm.
So you're a retired journalist. You had a long career. You worked as a projects editor for The Dispatch. You were executive director for Investigative Reports. How does your work as a journalist inform this charitable work you're doing now in your retirement?
It's been nice because as a journalist, as you know, you can't really become an activist or do a lot of volunteer things like this. So I feel free now to make a difference in a very different way from when I worked as a journalist. I think the natural curiosity of being a journalist, being able to do quick research, and then just the willingness to talk to people and hear their stories. The stories are amazing. With Montagne de Luz and also with Conversation Partners. So I think that natural curiosity, the ability to make a difference and to connect with people in real life has been such a pleasure.
Does your journalism bug still in there? So you'll have a conversation with someone and you're like, oh, that's such a good story.
Yes. And sometimes I suggest those stories. We also have a website with MontagneDeLuz.org. And sometimes we tell those stories. And, you know, my first conversation partner is a young man from Turkey who spent 3 years in prison, and he was a teacher. His wife spent a year in prison. So you hear these stories and you realize all the things we take for granted in this country. People can't take that for granted in many places around the world.
And do you have another plan to go back to Honduras soon? How many trips are you planning in your retirement?
I would like to go back soon. I will likely go back next January. Our church is doing another trip in January, February next year. There may be other opportunities later this year. I missed the kids and the staff already and would love to be back as soon as I can.
Well, and the kids probably are just like growing up. If you only see them occasionally, you're like, oh, you're so much bigger now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's part of it. And then we also have we had some newer residents at our children's home that I had not met when I was there in 2022. So it's just always a joy to spend time with them. And they look forward to these groups coming down because more people to play volleyball with and do crafts with and get to know and spend time with.
Well, good luck with both of your nonprofits. That's Doug Haddix, who serves on the board of directors for Montaña de Luz, a nonprofit organization that empowers children and families affected by HIV/AIDS in Honduras. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.